We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Plenty to cover, starting with a strike this week.
Yeah, there was a fast food workers strike starting on Wednesday night and going into Thursday. It was the National Strike for Poverty, which happened in Seattle, New York City, Chicago, Detroit, St. Louis, and Milwaukee, among other cities. Here in Washington, at least a half a dozen restaurants closed. There may have been others in addition. There, Burger King's were involved, Subway's, Taco Bell's, Chipotle's, and at least one Taco Del Mar in the U District. The workers' demands when they walked off the job on Thursday was that they wanted to be paid at least $15 an hour rather than the $9 and change that you get if you're paid minimum wage in the state of Washington. And they wanted the bosses to not retaliate, to allow them their rights under the Constitution to organize. Now, I want to just point out here that $15 an hour is not an unreasonable demand. If you add that up, figure out if a person working full-time makes $15 an hour, they can probably afford an apartment and food and utilities in the city of Seattle. Of course, not a lot more than that. And a lot of these workers don't work full-time because their managers don't want to pay benefits. As you may recall, the city of Seattle requires healthcare, requires paid sick leave. And there are other healthcare requirements under the upcoming Affordable Care Act that require employees to be working a minimum of 30 hours a week.
Not that they weren't rotating people out of full-time jobs and into part-time jobs
anyway,
before those took effect.
But it's mostly
because there's also company policies.
Yeah. Yeah, it's mostly to avoid paying benefits.
Yeah.
Most minimum wage employees who work in Seattle don't actually live in Seattle, and so they have typically a long commute or lots of commute expenses. That makes it really, really hard for them to look for better paying jobs or to go to school in order to eventually qualify for a better paying job. So this was a really welcome thing to see these guys walk out and say, we're closing the fast food industry for the day.
Yeah, and it didn't get that much local media attention, which I thought was interesting too.
Surprising.
And if you are coming into Seattle, either the parking is outrageously high,
yes,
or our bus system is being dismantled as we speak.
So. Yeah, and it's a long commute for a lot of people to get here from places like Renton and Auburn.
And for a lot of part-time workers like that, they work swing shifts, they work erratic hours, and bus service is particularly difficult from outlying areas with more affordable housing and on evenings and weekends.
Yes.
So, it's a vicious cycle, really.
It is. So if you're curious about reading more about the strike for poverty, there's a number of groups working on that. Here in Seattle, it's a group called Good Jobs Seattle, the Washington Community Action Network, Working Washington, and One America. You can check out their websites.
All right. Well, on to one of our local parks that's been hiding a secret.
Yes, at a public meeting Wednesday night that was called by Representative Jerry Pollitt, who's a state representative from Northeast Seattle, the Seattle Parks and Recreation Department acknowledged for the first time that they had found radiological soil contamination in Magnuson Park out on the site of the former Sandpoint Naval Air Station in 2009, 4 years ago. They fenced off the affected area, but never told the public. They told the State Department of Ecology. They told the U.S. Navy, which was the former operators of the site, but they didn't tell the public, which is particularly damning for a couple reasons. Number one, there have been a number of public hearings since then around land use proposals for developing that area. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the whole reason it came to light now was because a sports arena was being put in that area right next to where the contaminated land is. That's why it was discovered in the first place.
Children's sports arena, right?
Yes, yes. The Seattle Parks Department first discovered the potential problems when an employee preparing for the lease to Arena Sports, who operates the arena, discovered a blueprint that labeled a room as the Radium Room, which at least he had the common sense to understand the implications of what that meant. The city notified the Navy and the Arena Sports, but not, and this is the Parks Department, of course, which has a long history of not being very open or forthcoming with the public and not getting much, being very interested in input from the public. So they didn't tell the public because they just decided that it was a low enough level of radiation that it didn't pose any kind of a risk. And because, and I loved this one, this was a direct quote from the Seattle Times article, that let's see, where's the quote here? But the basic gist of it was that they decided not to notify the public because as long as they fenced off the area, it was okay because nobody would go in there. Because the low-level contamination presents no threat as long as nobody enters the fenced-off area. Well, having been a teenager once,
fenced off areas are like catnip.
They exude a powerful magnetic draw, to anybody under the age of about 16. And of course, which is when growing bodies are more susceptible to radiological damage from contamination. So, The hearing on Wednesday night turned quite contentious, particularly because Representative Paulet, many people may recognize that name from his day job, which is that for the last couple of decades he's been the executive director of Heart of America Northwest, which is a Hanford Nuclear Reservation watchdog group. So Paulet probably has more experience in his little pinky than the entire rest of the state legislature has in their collective bodies with government assurances that radiological damage poses no danger and is all under control, thank you very much, and doesn't need to be shared with the public. He knows that song and dance painfully well. And it's some of the same actors. The State Department of Ecology, which is part of the tri-party agreement that oversees the dreadfully underfunded and decades behind schedule cleanup at Hanford, was the state agency that was notified in this case. We had the Seattle Parks Department, which, as I mentioned, has a long track record of not being responsive to the public, and the Navy. And as some people are aware, the military in this country is the biggest environmental polluter in the United States for the simple reason that they are exempted from almost every environmental regulation, mm-hmm. and therefore contaminate the environment pretty much with impunity and have done so for many decades. So the Parks Department and the Navy are saying, well, we've had a public hearing now, so that's that, and we don't need to discuss this any further. And they're doing a temporary, quote unquote, time critical cleanup. Why, if it's not a danger to the public, it's suddenly time critical is a good question. But they're saying they don't need any more public disclosure or discussion of this. And Paulet and a number of the angry neighborhood residents and environmentalists who were at the hearing Thursday night said, no, this isn't over. We're going to talk about it further. So we'll keep an eye on that one. It'll be around for a few thousand years.
Moving on, Mayor McGinn rallying the troops this week.
Yeah, Mayor McGinn has finally started rallying his major backers. And we saw endorsements this week from what you might call more mainstream environmental groups, although the Seattle PI came out and said that he received backing from some of the, what was the quote, most militant environmental leaders in the nation, including the Sierra Club, which I thought was hysterical.
Sierra Club and militant in the same sentence?
Yes. Which shows you where the PI is coming
from.
Can
we forward that to the Earth Liberation Front just for yucks and grins?
Just to see what they say, yeah.
Earth first, but, some of those folks.
But what really got people's attention on the left was endorsement from Bill McKibben, who's one of the main anti-global warming guys, and Van Jones, who's known for his work on anti-poverty stuff as well as environmental. And he's been pretty key in linking environmental issues to social justice, particularly when it comes to communities of color and poor folks. So that was a bit of a shock, I think, on the left to see those national folks come in and say yes, we support Mayor McGinn. And there's a reason why they did, and it's because compared to other mayors around the country, compared to other cities around the country, Mayor McGinn's policies on the environment look pretty good. But what these national folks don't realize is that this is mainstream politics here in this city, to be, pro bicycles, to be you know, anti-huge constructions for automobiles like the Mercer Corridor Mass or Mercer Corridor Beautification Project or the downtown traffic tunnel. That's pretty mainstream around here. It's not that controversial.
Although both those things happened while McGinn was mayor.
Yes, amazingly enough, even though he used particularly his opposition to the downtown traffic tunnel as a way to get elected. So that was a bit of a surprise to people on the left. But it also kind of showed that McGinn is really gearing up now to run a serious race. He's been pulling all the strings that he can for his base. Unfortunately for him, his base doesn't seem to be very broad. It seems to be sort of mainstream liberal environmentalists. It doesn't include labor groups who have been pretty quick to back the other candidates in the race, like Harrell and Murray, and not back McGinn. And the Democratic groups around town have been backing the other candidates. And it's kind of surprising that they bring up Mayor McGinn's name as a pro forma thing. And then nobody really votes for him. They go for the other candidates. So that's, I think, an indication of how much he's struggling in terms of putting together a pretty good base for his reelection.
All right. Let's move on. Analysis coming out this week about Washington State lobbyists.
Yeah. The Associated Press, KUOW, and KPLU did an analysis of Washington State lobbyists' expense reports. And what they found is that the state's 50 top lobbyists spent about $65,000 to feed various legislative representatives. And at the top of the recipients list, it's no surprise, the five top recipients are all Republican senators. At the top is Republican Senator Doug Erickson. He's the head of the Senate committee that focuses on environmental issues. And unsurprisingly, he's been dining out pretty regularly with lobbyists from energy and oil companies. Now, number two on the list is Republican Senator Steve Litzow of Mercer Island. Number three is Republican Senator Joe Fain of Auburn. Number four is Republican Senator Mike Hewitt of Walla Walla. And number five is Republican Senator Mark Schosler of Ritzville. Now, the state ethics laws say that representatives are only supposed to accept free meals from lobbyists on an infrequent occasions, but it doesn't really define what that means. So you get something like Erickson, who's at the top of the list of recipients, accepting so many paid meals from lobbyists that it's an almost everyday occurrence for him.
So, but you could do it, Sarah. You had one meal every 6 months or so. It was just an $8,000 meal.
Right. That's not what's going on. No. And a big part of the problem is that lobbyists' expenses are not submitted in the same way that campaign contributions are. So there's no electronic database. It's not online. People can't search through the database to see who's buying, you know, dinner for whom and when. You have to sort through all of these handwritten paper records, and they're in a terrible mess because a lot of times there are no receipts attached and there's not enough detail to tell really what the expense was for or who was actually there.
They're written on cocktail napkins.
That kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Along with the agreements to back various legislation written by the people who are paying for dinner.
So that's the sort of thing that should obviously be changed. We should be able to search those in an electronic online database and find out who's paying for what.
All right. Moving on to national, beginning with a FBI nomination for new.
Yeah, numerous reports this week, although the nomination, as far as I know, hasn't formally happened yet, that James Comey will be President Obama's new head of the FBI. And a lot of positive mainstream press about Comey, who is a Republican, and of course, aside from the usual, oh, isn't that nice, Obama's being bipartisan stuff, because, of course, as we all know, that putting Republicans in his administration will make the rest of the Republican Party much less likely to hate Obama and more likely to cooperate with him. Mike, you've got to get that laugh track We really need it for this show.
No, in fact, it gives them an excuse to target his more liberal members of his cabinet instead.
There aren't any.
they're rapidly disappearing.
But Comey is, if the name sounds familiar, he enjoyed some brief public attention during the Bush administration, where he was an assistant attorney general. Originally, he was a U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, which, of course, is where Wall Street is, and I'll get back to that. But as acting attorney general, when John Ashcroft was in for surgery and seriously ill, he stepped in and prevented then White House chief of staff Andrew Card and then White House attorney, later also attorney general Alberto Gonzalez, from literally bullying John Ashcroft into signing off on the legality of what you may remember way back less than a decade ago, when warrantless surveillance of Americans without any court oversight or court order was considered a controversial thing. that he stepped in and prevented them from bullying Ashcroft into signing it. And this story got around, and he got a lot of commendation for being willing to stand up to the tactics of the thugs from the senior levels of the Bush administration. And for that reason, a lot of people are hailing his appointment as showing independence. And he did do some other things that showed some independence and willingness to think critically during the Bush administration. But, and you knew there was a but coming, he was a member of the Bush administration, and as such, he did a lot of really, really bad things. he did, in fact, he was one of the people who signed off on the legality of the Bush administration's torture policies. He did, in fact, sign off on the legality of the what was then illegal warrantless wiretapping program. No worries, because Congress later made it retroactively legal, which was very, very kind of them. And as Attorney General for the Southern District of New York, he was also one of the out front people defending the legality of the imprisonment without charges for 3.5 years of Jose Padilla, back when that practice also was considered controversial. Now, of course, the Obama administration, rather than jailing U.S. citizens who were suspected terrorists without charges, they just kill them. But and it's been interesting to see what he's done since the Bush administration as well. He went back to Manhattan, where he's been a hedge fund executive, which of course also shows a serious commitment to having a strong moral compass. And then he's also been one of a very outspoken proponent of continuation of the global war on terror and the global terror on war policies, which raises the interesting question of why President Obama, who just last week issued a major speech in which he said the global war on terror was over, is in the process of nominating to run the FBI, one of the lead agencies responsible for implementing that on U.S. soil, somebody who is so committed to those policies. And particularly when you put that in the context of Obama's also having appointed last year, with minimal congressional opposition, John Brennan, another Bush-era war criminal, as head of the CIA, another agency who has a long track record of abuse of civil liberties that was put on steroids by the various legislation that was passed post 9/11.
So it's having the effect of institutionalizing these policies that we thought were just a blip in history, the Bush administration. It's becoming part of the mainstream, and it's becoming literally institutionalized.
Well, some of us, including, as far as I remember, every person currently in this room, were saying at the time, 10 years ago, that the real danger of this is not just the abuses that are occurring now, but that it sets a precedent for the future.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And that is exactly what has happened. Obama came into office saying, well, we won't prosecute any of these people because we want to look forward, not back. And then looking forward, he has not only maintained but even expanded many of these policies. And because it's been done now by a Democratic president as well as a Republican one, it's no longer considered controversial by either lawmakers or the corporate media, and it's become institutionalized. That's absolutely correct, and it's really very, very frightening. When Padilla was imprisoned in 2002, that was the first time in roughly 800 years in the West that the people were thumbing their nose at the Magna Carta. And that was considered a horrifying thing, at least by a handful of civil libertarians. And let's just go kill people if we don't like them. It's very, very troubling that Obama is nominating these folks. And you've even got some on the left, you know, fans of Obama, saying that, well, Comey's a great nomination because he stood up you know, to Gonzalez during the Bush administration time, and being willing to completely overlook that he signed off on all these policies that were considered dreadful at the time, and then in fact still are dreadful, only now he'll be in charge of implementing them.
All right, let's move on. GMOs found in Oregon.
Yeah, genetically modified wheat was discovered in a farmer's field in the state of Oregon this week. It turns out that it's Monsanto's Roundup-resistant variety of wheat, which has never, ever been approved for use in the United States or anywhere in the world.
Weren't there a couple million people upset about Monsanto last week?
Yeah, you know, Monsanto tested this genetically modified wheat in 16 states from about 1998 through 2005, including in Oregon and Washington. And in 2005, it withdrew its application with the USDA when other nations started banning the importation of genetically modified food, and especially Japan, which was one of the earliest nations to do that. Japan, of course, is the biggest importer of U.S. wheat. About $8 billion in U.S. wheat is exported every year. That's about 50% of the entire U.S. crop. And about 90% of Oregon's crop is exported to other countries. And I'm sure it's about the same for the state of Washington.
And a lot of Washington's goes to Japan as well.
Yeah.
Or did.
Yeah, and most of that wheat is for human consumption, unlike genetically modified U.S. corn and soybeans, most of which goes into animal feeds, biofuels, and for packaging. The USDA says that it's going to be investigating why this wheat ended up in this Oregon field. Not that I expect that they will find an answer. More than 10 years after the last field test in Oregon was completed in 2001. But, you know, my guess is that, nature being nature, some of the Monsanto wheat crossed with ordinary wheat and got into the U.S. food supply and has been there for the last 10 years, and we just haven't known it. And of course, unsurprisingly, this week Japan announced that it was suspending all imports of U.S. wheat.
All right. Study on immigrants?
Yeah, there was a study this week released by the Harvard Medical School that U.S. immigrants put more into Medicare than they actually take out. This is, you would be shocked to hear this if you listen to the mainstream media, filled as it is with right-wing jingoists saying we must get rid of all immigrants because they're leeching on the system. It's actually quite the reverse. You might ask, how can this be? Well, it's because immigrants tend to be a lot younger than the general population, and they tend to be in better health than Americans. You might be astonished to hear that as well, if you believe the right-wing jingoists who say, oh, no, those dirty, nasty, sick immigrants coming here to take advantage of our great lifestyle. Well, the truth is that it's a well-known phenomenon that immigrants tend to come to another country when they're young and adaptable, and that they do tend to be in better health than Americans because they exercise more and they eat a better diet. It's a well-known phenomenon that when people immigrate into America, their health tends to get worse as they become more sedentary, drive more, and eat a fast food diet. Now, this same study also kind of pointed out too that the same phenomenon holds true with Social Security. Many immigrants, when they first come to America legally or otherwise, tend to try to get hold of a Social Security number, and they pay Social Security taxes. But particularly if they're not legal immigrants, they will never be able to draw from Social Security.
Actually, also if you have a green card, you can work legally. You pay into Social Security,
but you will never draw from it.
And mm-hmm. There are a lot of people in that situation.
And because immigrants tend to be a lot younger, for example, the average age of an Hispanic immigrant in the United States is 27 years old. Immigrants also tend to use less health care. They also will be paying into Social Security and Medicare for many, many more years than we would ordinarily expect. And currently, the Medicare Trust Fund and Social Security would just be in much worse shape without younger immigrants contributing to the plans. For example, U.S. citizens incurred a deficit of $28 billion to the Medicare program from 2002 to 2009, while at the same time, immigrants contributed a net surplus of $115 billion. So put that in your pipe and smoke it.
All right. Enron style accounting, briefly.
Yeah, Sallie Mae, the SLM Corporation, which finances student loans in the United States, is said that it is splitting into two companies. One is a big holding company that's going to take hold of $118 billion in outstanding student loans, and that's all that's going to be in that holding company.
Wait, I've seen this movie.
You have seen this movie, you have. And the second company is a new lean Sallie Mae bank, which will take deposits, and it will make more student loans. And now the guys who are engineering this split.
They're the smartest guys in the room.
Yes, they consider themselves the smartest guys in the room. And they said, well, this will allow the brand new Sallie Mae Bank to make many, many, many more student loans. They won't be burdened by all of this, debt. Which they now call assets since they're stuffing it into an entirely new company. Yes. Yeah, so if this sounds familiar, then you have heard of Enron and WorldCom. and really, this is terrible because it comes at a time when half of all student loans are in deferment because borrowers can't currently make payments on them. Total student loan debt has exceeded credit card debt officially for the first time in history. It's now over $1 trillion. And then interest rates on federal Stafford student loans are set to double it on July 1st from 3.4% to 6.8% unless Congress gets its act together and passes a bill that prevents that.
And that, again, is something Republicans have blocked a number of times over the past couple of years.
Yeah, you know, we've talked about the economic effect of student loans. We talked about that last week. But really, you have to ask, what is the purpose of hooking students on such heavy debt? And really, the purpose is that you have to, first of all, get students used to owing money. That's something they're going to have to do if they're going to be a middle-class American. But also, it really turns these students into indentured servants at a time of their life when they're really at their freest, when students have the time and the energy to radicalize and to organize, hooking them on heavy student debt and forcing them to work at the same time that they go to school cuts down on student organizing. And it is one of the ways that our system exerts social control.
Along with making higher education so unaffordable that a lot of people are just weeded out of it entirely.
Yeah, that only the upper class and the upper middle class can afford it.
All right. That leaves us all of 2 minutes to talk about British Columbia and tar sands.
Yeah, the provincial government of British Columbia yesterday morning officially announced that it would oppose the Northern Gateway pipeline proposed by Enbridge. That's a pipeline that would go from the Alberta tar sands plant roasting project in northern Alberta with a newly built port in the town of Kitimat on the north coast of British Columbia, just south of Prince Rupert and Ketchikan. That, of course, the purpose of that being so that the dirty oil from the tar sands would be exported to East Asia. The Enbridge plan is probably the most. There are two proposed pipelines that would go through BC to the Pacific coast. The Enbridge plan was considered the most politically viable of those. For people not familiar with the Canadian system, the pipelines there is a federally related project. So there's a federal panel which is expected to make a decision in December on this. But the provincial governments have much more power in Canada than state governments do in the United States. And the opposition of the BC government is expected to play a critical role in that decision. So it's a major blow to the ability of tar sands exporters to get a pipeline through the Pacific coast, since BC controls the entire Pacific coast of Canada. There is one other pipeline project there called Kinder Morgan project being backed by Canadian billionaire Conrad Black. That has a slightly different route also with a terminus in Kitimat where they would build a huge new terminal to accommodate that. But again, neither of those is considered as either financially or politically viable as the Keystone XL pipeline. The State Department expected to rule on whether they'd give approval to Keystone XL sometime later this month. And so particularly with the ability of exporters in Alberta to send that oil out to the west over the Rockies, it again becomes that much more critical that the Keystone XL be blocked.
All right. events?
Today, from 2 to 4 o'clock, there will be a Bradley Manning support march. Bradley Manning being the criminal who has been jailed as for being a whistleblower in the WikiLeaks case a couple of years ago. There was a national day of protests around that here in Seattle. People will be gathering at Westlake Park marching to Victor Steinbrück Park. Since they're going to take a couple hours, I imagine that's not going to be a direct route. Again, that'll be 2 o'clock at Westlake Park. Bradley Manning support march. Check it out.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.